Blog Talk Radio.
Talk Rock.
And we're live from Health 2.0, the seventh annual here in Silicon Valley, first year down here in the Santa Clara area, moving from San Francisco. This is Greg Masters. You're listening to This Week in Health Innovation. I'm your producer and co-host of the broadcast, and we have just been steeped in the innovation vibe for the last 4 days, starting Sunday. It's now Wednesday. I count four, but I can't be entirely sure. And joining me in the virtual booth today, actually, we're not virtual. We have a studio here in the press room at Health 2.0. Is Dr. Pat Salber, my colleague and co-host of the show. Pat, are you with us?
I am.
Excellent. We are within a stone's throw reach of each other, and we are just delighted on the broadcast today, and so consistent with this innovation theme here at Health 2.0. Our guest today is a man just who's amazing, just an amazing guy. I knew of him, but I hadn't really witnessed his message in person until the Digital Health Summit at CES in 2012. And I was fortunate to grab up that video, and he just blew it, hit it out of the park, knocked my socks off. And as I was listening to this guy, I said, this guy works for a health plan? How does that happen? This is impossible. So let me tell you about Reed Tuckson, and I'll kick it over to Pat, and we'll get to know this dynamic and brilliant man. Reed's a health professional engaged in enhancing the quality and effectiveness of healthcare delivery, an innovator in mobile and telehealth applications, a person interested in clinical science, and is responsible and its responsible translation into new health interventions, or as a health policy maker or implementer. His bio further notes, in nearly every sector of health and medical care, including serving as the Commissioner of Public Health for the District of Columbia, the Senior Vice President for Programs at the March of Dimes Foundation, the President of the Charles R. Drew University of Medicine and Science, the Senior VP for Professional Standards of the AMA, and the EVP and CMO, or Chief of Medical Affairs for United Health Group. This is a man who's got incredible standing in the conversation. So free from what might have been, shall we say, quote, constraints in the past, we're going to hear from him today. And with that, as brief bio, I'll hand it over to Pat Salber.
Well, this is really exciting because, Reed, I think you and I first met each other, I think it's probably 20 years ago, and really looking forward to catching up with what you're doing now and also having you share your perspectives during this historic time. The exchanges went live yesterday and the government shut down on the same day. So I think we have a lot of stuff to talk about. So Reed, I think I'll start off by saying, tell us what you're up to now. I know that you've recently left United Healthcare and you now have your own company. What are you doing?
Well, thank you so much, and it's just a great joy to be with you and your listeners. And I will say that right now what I'm trying to do is to continue on my personal journey of integrating the various pieces of the puzzle that are necessary to work in concert to make a meaningful difference in healthcare. And what I mean by that, I'm very fortunate to be involved in large community-scale integrated medicine and public health, where we can put together the combination of community-based population health promotion disease prevention initiatives and stitch those seamlessly using data and analytics and other tools with the primary care delivery system. I'm also very active involved with the issue of data and analytics and how do we use data and analytics to inform personally appropriate healthcare choices. I'm also engaged in the effort for advancing or extending the quality of care that's delivered in our clinical settings. I still care a lot about the evaluation of quality, but also how do we help make quality work through new innovations in healthcare, in particular telehealth. I'm the fortunate to be the vice chairman of the board of the American Telehealth Association, so I see those tools coming together in an integrated way. And then I'm also very much interested in the fields of innovation around biotechnology and how do we figure out the difficult solutions to having affordable and well-used new innovations in biotechnology that will be appropriate for the needs of individuals and used in a way that not only advances quality but doesn't waste money and cause ultimately negative consequences. And so I spend a lot of time in the biotech world. So I put those pieces of the puzzle together with a few others, and I hope that I'm going to be one person that is working to help enhance the overall quality of health.
Wow, well, so that's a huge spectrum of things that you're doing, and I hardly know where to start, but I think what would be really interesting is, you know, this biotech has been a challenge in healthcare because of the incredible promise of these new drugs, but also the incredible price.
So can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in biotech and how you're going to help to make that food more accessible?
You know, Pat, I lost a little bit of the last part of your question, but I think you asked the notion of how do we make these new biotech drugs, which are so expensive, more affordable and more accessible. And that really is the challenge. I am greatly concerned, as I think we all should be, that the economic costs for new innovations are increasingly extremely expensive. And I think that what that means is that we will inevitably hold these new technologies to much greater scrutiny for whether or not it produces value. Value that is evaluated in three ways. One, does it actually improve the overall quality of health in a meaningful and measurable way, especially when compared to existing forms of treatment when there is an existing form of treatment? Number two, does it reduce costs? Does it eliminate emergency room visits, hospitalizations, length of stay, and readmissions? And then third, what is value in terms of the meaning for the individual? How do people view the incremental contribution of the new innovation in a way that that really has some component of the excess in value? So I think those three criteria are going to be important. I know ultimately, finally, that the affordability question for innovation will heavily depend upon the discipline of the delivery system in using it, and the ability of the insurance companies to implement appropriate medical management that causes the drugs or the innovation to be used only in the clinical conditions under which it is warranted. I will conclude by worrying out loud with you and your listeners that as we look at this problem, the availability to support these innovations and the ability of small innovation companies to conduct the research necessary to convince people who have to pay the bills of value will all be important challenges, and there are not easy answers to those questions.
Yeah. So are you hearing me okay?
I hear you well now. Thank you.
Okay, good. So I recently had a discussion with a physician executive from Genentech who works in the area of cancer drugs, particularly these new personalized drugs that are very targeted to a certain part of a particular cancer's pathway. And he explained the economics of how you develop these drugs, and they're just hugely expensive. And, of course, we have to do a lot of work to try and make clinical trials much easier to perform and much less expensive. But nevertheless, the price tag on these drugs is going to be huge, and the number of people for whom they will
truly bring the value that you talked about is going to be small. It's really hard for me to see how we're going to be able to both continue to support the development of these complicated, very targeted, and life-saving treatments, and at the same time kind of meet the other two criteria that you had for the value equation, which were more population-based.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head, and that is clearly this notion that these new incredibly wonderful drugs, and especially considered wonderful if you are the parent of a child suffering from a rare disease, or you are someone who is dying from a cancer that has been heretofore untreatable with conventional therapeutic regimens. These are really fantastic new innovations, which we would all, I think, want to succeed. But you're right, the smaller the population of people for whom it is appropriate, the more challenging becomes the economics. I think the only thing that I know is that the one message that I continue to give, and I think it has some resonance with the patient advocacy community, is that the patient advocacy community is going to need to not only be strong advocates for research and strong advocates for the introduction of therapeutics for their condition, they also are going to have to be strong advocates for getting the waste and the poor quality out of the delivery system generally. We will never have enough money to afford the new stuff if we continue to be walking down a road, as the IOM has taught us, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences has taught us, that there is $750 billion of waste in the healthcare system today. We really have got to root that waste out if we're going to be able to afford the good things that are coming down the road.
Right. I'm actually a big fan of getting the waste out. I just wonder if we sweep the waste out, that money actually would end up going into places where the drug development is taking place. And so it's going to lead me to ask you another question, which is, particularly perhaps whole debate right now, have been for the last year or two, about the role of government in healthcare. What do you think, do we need to have more of an investment in the drug development through NIH as opposed to the private sector? Or is there some whole new model that we need to put into place to be sure that that these drugs can be continue to be developed but also continue to be priced at a range that makes them accessible to people who need them?
Well, I serve, and I need to declare that I serve on the personal advisory committee for the head of NIH, and I am very comfortable with the sensitivity on the part of NIH to make the research investment by the American public available and key to your question, translatable from the bench basic science into meaningful therapeutics. So I'm very comfortable from my observation post that we're doing a lot of that. I will tell you, though, Pat, that the issues like the sequestration that the federal government has been operating under for months is a serious impediment to the capability of NIH to be able to do all the things that it wants to do. And I will tell you that this shutdown that the government has experienced is an overwhelming impediment. That being said, I am very interested in the agenda recently announced by NIH in its brain-related work, diseases of the brain. And as we all know, and as you know as well as I, issues like Alzheimer's and other such dementias are very important. And so having new science that can be translated into new therapeutic opportunities is going to be key. So I think the answer to your question is yes, NIH is going to be very important in producing research that is translatable, and there is a clear sense of their responsibility to make research translatable. However, even with that, I would say to you that we're going to need a lot more private sector engagement and venture capital availability to these companies that are trying to do well. But having said all of that, we need to be very explicit that companies that are producing new ideas and new products need to be sure that they are producing things that will have value. If they're trying to game the system, if they're trying to just, do something and put heavy price tags on things that don't really add any real value, those products will not survive, and they should not survive in a marketplace where the average American continues to have to pay more and more out of pocket for medical interventions.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word marketplace because I'm going to shift gears now and ask you a few questions about the new healthcare marketplaces that just went live yesterday. And I know that there have been some glitches. I actually look at it as a good thing that so many people have been calling the exchanges that some of the exchanges couldn't handle the capacity. So there's good news, bad news. The bad news is they couldn't handle the capacity. The good news is that there's been overwhelming interest in these marketplaces. What is your view? How do you think they're going to change the overall healthcare picture? Where do you think they're going to go forward in the future?
I've spent, like others I'm sure, but I've spent 40 years of my life being concerned with, fighting for, and trying to advance universal access to healthcare for all Americans. And I've done that and been helpful, tried to be helpful in that regard at every stage of my career. And some people even find that surprising, even when I was 13 years at United Health Group, which also put a lot of effort in trying to figure out ways to solve this problem. So I am, like you, optimistic, and I'm pretty clear that when we look at the long arc of history, over the next few years for sure, I think that we will find that these are going to be really wonderful steps. If there was a glitch or two at the beginning on the first day or the first week or the first month, you know, in the long view of life, it's going to be trivial. They'll figure it out and they'll work it out. I do hope, and I will say that, that government is not always or not usually very good at implementing some of these kinds of infrastructure issues. The private sector is very good at it, and hopefully we'll bring in some of the private sector expertise to solve it. But however it gets solved, it will get solved. What do I think it will mean for the long run? It is just an absolute tragedy for the numbers of people in America who suffer unnecessary human misery, whose lives are cut short, whose productivity in the workplace is blunted. It is just a tragedy that that could occur when we need to be so involved in and it's so available for us to solve or to get at this universal access to health care for all Americans. And so I'm just feeling that this will be major. Now, the things that go with the overall package, of course, there are so many variables that will have a lot to do with it. But most of the things that I'm excited about that have been occurring as a part of the Affordable Care Act are things that were pioneered, I think, in the private sector and that we know work well. For example, changing the reimbursement system for physicians to reimburse physicians and hospitals for value, for the quality of care they deliver and not for piecework. That's very important. Reimbursing and stimulating modernized delivery systems that provide comprehensive, coordinated care for people. That's very important. We know from the private sector experience that those things not only work, but they're essential. We know that it is important for data to flow with the patient across settings of care so that if people who are chronically ill, who may have more than one physician, go to hospitals, clinics, who need social support services. We know how important it is that data flow so that everybody can be on the same page, focused on the needs of the patient. So those things are all very important. So I think that what we're going to see are profound accelerators from this bill that will happen and move forward things that have been developed in the private sector. And I'm very excited about those changes because we have to have solutions that will keep healthcare affordable for people, but also we've got to attend to the quality problem that plagues medical care today. Every American deserves quality care in addition to deserving access to care.
Yeah, absolutely. So over the last, 10 or 20 years where people have really been focused on quality of care, starting with thinking about medical errors in the kind of hallmark report from the Institute of Medicine about how many medical errors there were. I think it was 94,000 to 100,000. I forget the exact numbers, but it was in that range. But there was a recent report speaking to whether we've made progress or not that said, in actual fact, that number is far smaller than the number of medical errors that we actually have. Have we made any progress, Reed? And if we haven't, why not? And what can we do going forward to try and really make a difference in this quality problem?
I think that certainly I think we have made progress. And I think the reason we've made progress is because, first, the attentiveness to the issue is higher. It used to be in the old days you couldn't measure what was really going on in terms of the quality of care. Now we have very robust performance measures, both on the quality of care and the cost effectiveness of care. And increasingly, we're starting to have measures that tell us about the patient's satisfaction with care, whether the individual believes that they were treated with respect and dignity and so forth. So I think the ability to measure it is much, much higher. And that means that we may think that we're reporting more problems, but really what we're also doing is making everyone aware of it. And in addition to the measures and the reporting, is that those reports are being made transparent so that everybody can see the problem. And that, I think, is also very important. Where I think the next horizon is going to come on the quality and safety will be on being able to take the databases, the data and analytics, the ability to analyze the data around how care is delivered and what an individual person needs, whether they got the appropriate care and whether there were gaps in care, taking that information and building it into decision support tools that the physician can have readily available. If you can imagine that medical care today is already extremely complex, and as you ask in your question, or as you put in the thesis of your question, the genetic revolution is going to complicate medicine by multiple degrees of difficulty. And so if we're having trouble today with today's tools, imagine how challenging it will be to deliver good quality and appropriate care with in a genomic era. That means that physicians will need to have information and decision support tools at their fingertips when the patient walks in the door. I think we're making a lot of progress in that area, but there's an awful lot of room to go to get us to where we need to be.
Well, it's very interesting that you bring up all this data because I'm here at Health 2.0, and a big theme here, as a matter of fact, it was the focus of a panel this morning, is big data and how big data is being used and analyzed. And by the way, it isn't only traditional healthcare data, claims data, and the kind of stuff that we're used to in the past, but people trying to figure out how to integrate all the sensor data. There was an excellent presentation yesterday from a company called Esri that actually does what they call geomedicine, and they're mapping toxic areas and all sorts of things about the environment that impact health. And all of that data is going to somehow end up on the lap of the providers. Are you involved in any of that? What do you think about that? Is this going to be revolutionary or is this going to be overwhelming?
I don't think that I can envision any kind of a model where all of this data just pours in unfiltered to a clinician. For example, you and I can take our iPads today, connect very easily a blood pressure monitor, and then take our blood pressure off our iPad and download that into a doctor's office. Can you imagine a busy physician being bombarded with those kinds of streams of data? Can't happen. And so what's going to happen is that we will see intermediaries who will come forward and package that information, assemble it for physicians in a useful way. The challenge for those industries will be who is the customer for their product, how much are they willing to pay, and what's the value for those things. And those are things and details that have to be worked on. But the more that the reimbursement system is one based upon quality and value, and the more that, that we can get to a place away from fee-for-service and towards a reimbursement that is aligned with appropriate care that saves dollars, the more that there is that dollar savings in care delivery and it gets rewarded in reimbursement, the more you're creating markets for those new tools and capabilities.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I want to shift gears again because there's so much to talk about with you. And you mentioned that you're very involved in telehealth, and I would like to hear a little bit because I think there's tremendous opportunity for telehealth to help squeeze out waste and get us to a more efficient system. And I'm particularly interested in the role of telehealth in rural health. Is that an area that you're involved in?
Well, yes, it is. And the American Telemedicine Association has a very specific interest on being able to make much more available the expertise of specialists who can be connected to primary care and or nurse-run clinics in rural America and also in inner-city America, so that you can be able to use the tools that are accompanying innovations in broadband and wireless technology that allow video communication to happen synchronously, clearly, and in a way that's not obtrusive, so that you can be in different places and watch or talk with a care provider and it seems like they're in the same room. There are wonderful new tools for being able to listen to the heart, listen to the lungs, be able to examine the skin, examine the eye, all of those physical examinations with high-resolution tools that allow very accurate engagement with a person. So, yes, being able to extend into rural America and inner-city America are going to be very important. Where the big concern, Pat, is that we are seeing a challenge with state medical boards who are putting up barriers towards the licensure of physicians across state lines. And the world has moved so much beyond the geographical limitations of space to being a different kind of world. And some of these innovations are being impeded by medical boards who are stuck in the Marcus Welby era, and we're going to have to hope that that there's some progress there.
Well, at the risk of getting a bunch of arrows in my back, I personally think that we shouldn't have 50 state boards. There should be one national board that governs all of the licensure of healthcare. There's so much waste in having all of these different boards, and if a physician wants to get licensed in four or five states, each one has different rules. Each one has fees. It just, as you said, it makes no sense, and it's so 1.0. Need to move forward. I want to finish up by sort of talking about something that's in both of our past, and that's the work that you and I both used to do with violence prevention. And I'd like to know if I have you provide us some insight on where you think that fits in this whole picture of improving the health of people in the U.S., and I'll pass it over to you.
Well, I had a little bit of challenge. I think you were talking about prevention. Did I get that right?
I'm sorry, I was talking about the work that you and I both used to do in violence prevention.
Yes, there was a little bit of an echo, and I missed the part of which part of prevention. Thank you. I am so glad that you continue to be focused on prevention of violence. It is a field that had a lot of attention a few years ago, and people are starting to forget, I believe, that violence is a public health problem as much as it is a criminal justice problem. And I will tell you that this episode with Mr. Zimmerman in Florida certainly got a lot of people's attention and made people really start to wonder what happens with in terms of some of this violence and especially interracial tensions, which remain so much at the heart of the nation. And, of course, we all understand the concerns of things that happened at the Navy Yard or the recent episodes in Colorado. Unfortunately, there's too long a list that talks about what happens in terms of our rage and or when mental illness marries together in the horrible spot of access to weaponry of very powerful means. I think that what we have to remember when it comes to this issue of violence is that we need multidimensional solutions. We need to be very clear that we have to learn to understand how our society works. Public health is at its core focused in the intersection of all the crossroads of our society. And so we've got to be standing inside of our society and looking around at all the factors and the forces that are going on if we're going to be able to reach people. And of course, we're going to have to continue having this robust national dialogue about access to guns. And I think the public health community is going to need to be very, very smart and very thoughtful about how we have that conversation with our fellow citizens in a way that does not polarize it unnecessarily. I think that we can have this conversation in a more rational and reasonable way with the majority of Americans, but we have to be careful that we learn to listen as much as we stand on our pulpits and dictate. And so the national conversation becomes important. And lastly, I think that what we also come to understand how important it is that we integrate behavioral health with physical health interventions. That there are so many, unfortunately, people in our society who are damaged, who are struggling, and who need intervention. And I think that we need to be clear as we continue to move forward with this integration of behavioral health with physical health and start to look at people holistically as entire, complete human beings and not segregate them in terms of how we relate to them by organ systems. And so I think all of that really gets to what we have to do for a solution.
Well, that was fantastic, Reed. As always, wonderful talking, and I'm so glad with your eclectic background that you're going to continue to do great work to improve the health of people in the U.S.
Well, thank you, and it's been a joy being with you, and thank you for the opportunity, and take good care.
And that'll have to be the last word. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Reed Tuckson. Check him out on the web, drreedtuckson.com. Thank my co-partner here in Stewart, Pat Thalber, for her competent guidance of the chat. And we're going to stay focused here on what we're doing at Health 2.0. We're doing another day of interviews, which we'll be broadcasting both on the drwaysin.com and healthinnovationmedia.com. Until now, this is Greg Masters saying bye now and catch you next Wednesday on This Week in Health Innovation.